Welcome back to another fantastic episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my two compatriots. There is Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey.
Hey. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're just joining us for the first time, thank you and welcome to our wonderful, wonderful show. We will be doing a feature review of a recent theatrical release. Today we'll be talking about Like Someone in Love, the follow-up to Certified Copy by director Abbas Kiarostami. Before we get into that, we will be having a movie discussion topic tying into our feature review. We'll be talking about the gap between festival release and wider cinematic release that we have to endure for movies of this type. Then after all of that is done, we will be giving you our recommendations for movies coming out on Blu-ray and into theaters in the week ahead, along with a random recommendation of something that we have watched in the past week or so. Before we get into all that, though, let me say that you should find us on iTunes. You should subscribe to us. Perhaps you should also leave a comment and a rating, because those things are important. Still working on why. But it's really nice to hear from you. Speaking of which, if you'd ever like to email us, you can get in touch with us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. That about covers it. So guys, we can get started. Let us talk about the really awful, interminable wait that we usually have to go through between a movie premiering and getting press at a film festival and finally like entering theaters or VOD so that we can actually lay our eyes on it. What do you think about this? Do you like the anticipation buildup, or do you hate the fact that somewhere in the world there is someone who got to see this movie before you? So Danny, why don't we start off with you?
Well, I think there are two sides to it that you kind of pointed out. Obviously, the initial reaction is that it's hard to kind of hear about people, say, at the Cannes Film Festival that are seeing movies like Amour or Beyond the Hills or maybe today Like Someone in Love nearly a year before you'll get to see it. So obviously, the first couple days surrounding the premieres of those movies are kind of flushed with this anticipation and this desire to want to see those movies as soon as possible. But the more I've thought about it, I think there's something kind of healthy to the layover that happens in terms of the wait from festival release to theatrical release. Because a lot of times, you know, I've been to festivals, I've been to the New York Film Festival a couple of years now, and it's not always the sort of best environment to see a movie and judge it accurately in. It's sort of a different kind of experience. And in terms of me judging my reaction to a movie accurately, I feel that a festival setting doesn't always cater to that. So I kind of like hearing about a movie, kind of gauging its reaction a little bit, and then shelving it, and then coming back to it when it hits theaters, because it's just kind of like a fresher, safer approach than it would be if you're kind of sitting in a room with people that are the first ones to ever see a movie with so much anticipation.
Nick Newman, agree, disagree?
I would say I tend to agree. I find that there are instances where, yes, the wait can be unbearable, and there are other times where we, as people who attend press screenings, are given a special privilege. I remember going to see The Tree of Life the day it premiered at Cannes, which, granted, was only 11 days before its theatrical opening, but was still pretty cool because I felt like I was sort of part of the experience, for instance. And then there are other times where I'll hear, you know, so I have that instant reaction, but then there are other times where I'll hear about a film, and we kind of discussed this on an earlier episode, there's quote-unquote festival hype, and then you see it, and there's sort of a disconnect between your reaction and what you've been hearing for months and months. And it is a dangerous thing, and I think that the festival layover is something that we've become more and more accustomed to over time. And I think that it's something that you develop as you yourself develop a greater interest in film. Because if you're only going to see things that come out in a big theater, such as when you're a younger fellow, then it's not really going to be a problem. But it is something that I think has become a benchmark of cinephilia in some ways. And, you know, it can be a it could be a hassle, but there's something sort of communal about it, waiting around.
Nick, you bring up a very good point, because most of my friends, they really couldn't care about the type of thing that we're talking about right now. This may be one of the more vaguely elitist and specialized conversations that we've ever had. And a lot of that has to do with, like you said, the fact that we are not people who just like to go see things that hit the wide release, come out in theaters, have their trailer aired during the Super Bowl. Not that I don't enjoy movies like that. I'm ridiculously excited for the new Fast and Furious movie, which is a dark pop culture confession, I suppose. But yeah, for me personally, and for people like me, I think that this festival layover is awful. It's an awful thing to have to endure. I mean, even just now, I know films that people have seen that I'm still waiting for, To the Wonder by Terrence Malick, Upstream Color by Shane Carruth. Like, that's just off the top of my head. I'm sure there are others that you could tell me, like, people have seen, and I'll be like, oh, right, I'm still waiting for that. Last year was ridiculous. We had Amore. We had Lawless. And now we still have, like, things like The Place Beyond the Pines. And we only are just now getting to see Abbas Kiarostami's new film. But again, it's a specialized problem. And the flip side of it is that there are movies that come out that do get the hype. And things like Beasts of the Southern Wild, Ain't Them Bodies Saints is one that apparently made a big splash at the Sundance Film Festival. Those are films that I would never have even known about were it not for the types of things that I get annoyed about for films that I already know are coming. So I think it's a good trade-off, because in some ways, it's annoying to know that the movie that you're already anticipating is only getting premiered one place, and then you have to wait 6 months, even though you've already been waiting like 2 to 3 years. And yet, there's a whole new film now that I'm looking forward to in a completely different way. So I don't know. I guess it's one of those things. Like so many things in life, there's an upside and a downside. And I prefer to try to focus on the upside. But the bigger problem with things like that is I don't know when any of the films that are really big at Sundance are getting released.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like there's the Escape from Tomorrow. Apparently a very awesome film. Numerous people have seen it, people whose opinions I trust. And even the ones who didn't like it still said it was an interesting formal exercise and like the story behind it is interesting. Will I ever get to see it? I have absolutely no idea. And that's a whole different kind of annoying than knowing that I'm going to get to see it, but probably going to have to wait until award season.
Yeah, a film not getting released is always going to be a little worse than the wait. But another thing, just speaking personally, as I mentioned earlier, I've been going to the New York Film Festival for the past 2 years, so I saw Like Someone in Love there, and then I rewatched it for this podcast. So one of the pluses about the kind of festival dynamic, at least for me, is if you're able to go, you can kind of see movies twice before you really get into them. I know because we already had reviews from Cannes for a lot of these movies, I got to see like Someone in Love and Amore like more than once before we talked about them. And I sort of think that's kind of a cool process to watch something, then sit on it for a few months and then watch it again and come back and discuss it. So, but obviously that's only a benefit if you can see them at the festival in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, back in, I guess it was October, I saw the film Something in the Air, which I don't know if anybody else is looking forward to that or knows about it.
Yeah, I didn't see it there, but
well, yeah, it's just strange because I saw it then, and it will still not be coming out for about 2.5 more months. It comes out on May 3rd, I believe, in limited release. So that is part of the experience. Is you can there's sort of a displacement there for you. And another example of that is, you know, at Tribeca in 2011, I saw Beyond the Black Rainbow, which didn't open until May of 2012. And it was just a whole lifetime of events that transpired in that time for me. And it was very strange when people suddenly, now I can talk about it, but, oh, wait, that's right, I haven't seen it in somewhere around 13 months. And then there are some films, you know, Jordan, listening will know, there's this film we saw called Magic Valley at that same festival, which has still never been released. And it seems like it will never be released, even though it's quite good. That's the biggest anomaly, I think, is a festival movie that just never comes out.
Right, which is what I was talking about. Of course, I have never been to a festival, so I really have only the disappointments. I don't even get. I think the movie that I saw the earliest. Well, I guess this was technically at a festival. The AFI Silver Theater in Silver Spring, the American Film Institute, will do their European Union Film Showcase. And so I was actually able to see Certified Copy before it entered theaters here. That was its like U.S. premiere. And I think the same was true of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
So, very nice.
Yeah. So I guess that's cool. I guess that sort of counts. Though, I mean, again, like I said, it's a festival, but it's not one of those things that, you know, gets a lot of press. Though it absolutely should, because it's fantastic. AFI Silver. It's awesome, guys. Check it out. Completely unendorsed plug. Yeah, I can imagine that it would be awful to see a movie and then have to wait 13 months to be able to see it again or talk about it, but I wouldn't really know.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that bad because you can sit on it and let it stew, mm-hmm. but it's strange when suddenly people are talking about it. And you know, a film like that, Beyond the Black Rainbow, I remembered pretty well, but I even spoke to the director of that movie in June of last year, and we were just sharing about how strange it is for a filmmaker to have to wait that long for his own movie to come out when it's played and people have seen it and they've reviewed it and it's there, but there is that wait, which it's just fascinating to notice that, how sometimes it's a year and sometimes it's 10 days. But
yeah, and that kind of makes you wonder how that would affect like the filmmaker's working process. Like they debut a film at a festival, they do interviews for it, and then they find out it's going to be coming out in 7 or 8 months. Like, do they get started working on something new, or do they try to just promote that movie? Like, that would be kind of an interesting thing to discuss.
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't know if anyone's ever really asked that. I've never read anything about it, but
I know at Sundance this year, James Ponsoldt had a film called The Spectacular Now, and the year before he had a film called Smashed play there.
Yeah.
And Spectacular Now actually premiered really about just 2 months after Smashed opened theatrically. So there are some who seem to take advantage of that in one way or the other.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm out of things to say. I don't know about the rest of you.
That's always a good way to end a podcast topic.
Well, I mean, my personal thing is that I've never had to endure this. I've only ever had the wait. And you know what? I'm going to have to wait no matter what. So for me, it's more of just like a petulant 5-year-old, you know, he gets that toy. Why don't I get that toy? I want it now. And so I do my best to like tamp down that emotion. So there's really not a lot more for me to say unless I want to start sounding like the world's biggest entitled asshole. But does anyone else have any final thoughts to throw down before we move on?
I think we're good.
Yeah.
All right. So there's our thoughts on that. If you have any, you can always get in touch with us and let us know. But for now, let us move on into our feature review of Like Someone in Love, the newest film by Abbas Kiarostami, starring Tadashi Okuno and Rin Takanashi. Like Someone in Love is the story of Akiko, a young student in Tokyo who moonlights as a call girl slash companion slash escort slash prostitute. She is in a vaguely abusive relationship, and she is called to be the companion for the night of a man considerably older than her named Takashi, who is played by Tadashi Okuno. And yeah, sort of like you can't really sum up Certified Copy in a single sentence, just to use their most recent example. Like, that's two people discussing art while walking around town. I mean, that doesn't do anything. Like, it feels almost sacrilegious to attempt to bring this movie into a single line. Do either of you feel like you're capable of giving perhaps a better summary of the film, or do you kind of share my opinion that it's almost impossible to do it?
No, I don't think it's impossible.
Decent enough job? I just can't. Sure. I can't wrap my mind around the best way to, like, sell this movie to a friend.
There's a quote in the trailer that calls the film a case of willfully mistaken identity, which I think is a good way to put it, because this is a movie about people who are deceiving one another, and they're not exactly deceiving themselves, but they're sort of going along for the ride, if that doesn't sound completely superficial, which does sort of connect it back to Certified Copy, although it is, I would argue, less complex on that front, but more complex on several others, because like Someone in Love, in the several hours since I've seen it, I guess it's been about 15 or so, I've been trying to just get a better grip on it, but it's sort of slipping from my grasp, even though I don't think the film is impossible to figure out. It is just, it's very elusive, and it's very, even though much of the film takes place in real time, it feels very elliptical as well. And he's, Kiarostami is very fond of obscuring certain things from the audience, but also at the same time making it almost explicitly clear in a certain way, which was evident in Certified Copy and is evident here as well. And even if there are parts which don't quite make sense when you first encounter them, there is sort of a, there's a logic to it, and there is a, what's the word I'm looking for? A logic and kind of a consistency, where it doesn't feel as if he's making this up as he goes along. And there definitely are, there are certain layers to the storytelling and the characters, the way they're interacting with one another. And to speak of it so soon after seeing it feels a little silly, but here we are. And as it stands, I do really quite like the film. I think that the opening scene of it is, which is actually somewhere around the first 15 minutes, is one of the best opening scenes I've seen in years. I mean, it is just astoundingly good. And the rest of the movie I did find a bit cold, admittedly, but that is sort of the point, because the film is called like Someone in Love.
I'm a little confused. Could you clarify what part of like Someone in Love speaks towards coolness or coldness?
Well, because a lot of the feelings in it are, I think, artificial.
Okay. And so it's the like part of it.
Yes.
It's approximating someone in love, which is not the same as actually being in love. Yeah, I was going to ask you, because you tweeted out, you felt compelled to pause Like Someone in Love at the 16-minute mark to say, OMGGGGGGGGGG. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if that was a positive thing or a negative thing, because I definitely had the positive reaction. But,
no. It's positive, because the opening of this film just blew me away completely.
Yeah, I was blown away by numerous aspects of this film. It has the compositions and the kind of character interactions of Certified Copy, which is one of his more popular releases in America, so I'm going to go back to it a lot. It's also the one I've seen most recently, because I watched it like 2 weeks ago. And in that, you know, people are just talking to each other. Like, this is a movie that just basically lives on its dialogue and the things that people are doing and saying while they're saying it. And the idea of willful mistaken identity is a huge part of it that's really interesting and really kind of locks you up as you start watching it. There was a point where I had to pause the film as well. We should say we were watching this on screeners, so it's not like it was completely fine that we were pausing it. And I paused it expecting that I'd only been watching for like maybe 10 to 15 minutes. And I realized that I was already an hour into the film. It was like I had been taken in and entranced. It was moving at such a human and languid pace, but it was moving really rapidly, apparently, in my frame of reference in relation to time and space. Yeah, Danny, what did you think about this film?
I'm absolutely with you guys on the opening scene, as well as maybe the first 45 or 50 minutes in general. I think, you know, the first shot of the movie is kind of like we're in this bar restaurant in Tokyo, and we hear this voice, and there are a few faces in the distance, and we're kind of trying to make out which one is speaking. And then we pretty soon learn that the voice is off screen and it's the main character. And that's the way that scene unfolds, and the way it kind of delineates her relationships with various people, both in the room and outside the room, like the person she's on the phone with or her grandmother, is pretty amazing. More generally, the scenes that follow that, they're just kind of examples of how good Kiarostami is at controlling what isn't seen in the frame. A lot of the movie takes place indoors in, in Takashi's apartment, but we're always hearing the sounds of the city. They're always kind of invading the apartment and intruding on their discussions. And so he, the way he balances kind of the interiors and the exteriors of the film are kind of amazing. And those were my favorite moments where he was just kind of experimenting with that sort of dichotomy formally. Definitely the second half or the final hour, however you want to put it, lost me a little bit, kind of around the time when we meet Akiko's fiance boyfriend, because that's when the identities start really kind of shifting. And it wasn't that ambiguity wasn't as satisfying to me as it was in Certified Copy, just because I don't know really what it amounted to. It was kind of like a bunch of scenes of kind of backhanded dialogue and subtle allusions, but I don't know what it led to. It kind of has this really abrupt ending, and I'm still kind of trying to make sense of it.
Yeah, to call the ending abrupt is almost an understatement.
Yeah, it's like...
Yeah,
I
let out an audible, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's almost... It's almost abrupt. Like, if it was made by a first-time filmmaker, you would think they like left off a few frames from the editing room. Like, it's like ending credits, leave. It's like really kind of crazy. But
we'll get into that quickly. Yeah, I feel like we can't discuss much about this film and its themes without getting into spoilers. But
yeah, definitely. So overall, I'm kind of with you guys. Like, it's very good overall, but there's still parts I'm kind of grappling with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do agree that the sort of mystery that surrounds this film is not as enticing as Certified Copy. I think mostly because the mystery is actually, it's sort of non-existent. It's not really there. You understand?
I don't know what the mystery that we're talking about is.
Right. Well, no, because I think that there is sort of one at the film's center with the way that the characters are deceiving one another, and it's not entirely clear why they would be doing it, I think. But I don't believe that I don't believe it's actually that complex in that regard. Whereas Certified Copy could be read multiple ways. I'm not sure how many angles you could actually take like someone in love from, to be honest. Is not necessarily a what's that?
I was gonna say that's where I'm having trouble getting a mystery out of. I
feel it's more the why aspect that's frustrating. Like you know the characters, you know how they're sort of framing their identities, but it's not really satisfying as to why they would be doing that.
I can think of only one character where I might have questions regarding that.
All right, yeah. Well, we can get into it
in spoilers, but yeah, yes, right. please continue.
And also, yeah, there isn't that sort of... I hate to use this term because it feels a little... It feels like an unnecessary complaint, but there isn't that level of relatability that came with Copy, I believe. I think that this is a little more abstract and distant, which is not something that I will necessarily level against the movie because I do really like it, but it is something that does hold me back from having a really true emotional reaction. I think that it's a beautiful film, both visually and I think narratively too, but it doesn't exactly... I refer to this film as elusive, and what I also mean by that, in addition to just the traditional definition, is that I sort of can't get a grasp on how I feel about the characters or their predicament ultimately. It feels as if maybe we talk about how the film ends so abruptly. It feels as if we're meant to just sort of leave right away, and we can sit on it later, but if we do, we need to understand that these are not... These are extraordinary circumstances that they're in, and I think that sort of takes away a bit from the intended impact, if that is the intended impact, I should say.
And speaking in emotional terms, I was also left cold by the movie. The one scene that had a actual like emotional impact on me was when she's in the cab. It's kind of like the second sequence in the movie.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
She's just like listening to voicemails from her grandma. It's kind of this signature Kiarostami scene with her in a car, and like the city of Tokyo is kind of reflected on the windows. It's like pretty amazing because nothing that's said in the scene, like we get the gist of it that she's kind of ditching her grandmother, and yet he lets 7 messages play that basically say the same thing. But it really does have an amazing resonance and kind of says some things about modern alienation. Everything else really does seem like it goes back to the title, where it's like fake affection or fake emotion, so it doesn't have an impact. And that left me unsatisfied, even though it does seem, I guess, like the design of the movie.
Yeah, I do agree that the movie is cold. There's really no other way to put it. And that the scene where she's driving around in the back of the cab listening to the messages that her grandmother left was especially impactful to me, because I'm actually going to New York tomorrow. I'm going for a single day. I'm not even spending the night to be there for my grandmother's surprise birthday party.
Oh, nice.
Right? So I was like, you know, I'm going 4 hours in 2 directions in a single 24-hour period to see my grandmother. Yours went to your city and is just waiting for you, calling you all day. Like, just go see your grandmother. It was like frustrating and like really saddening and depressing to me. So that really hit home. But then the rest of the movie never approaches that same feeling. And I know it's kind of supposed to be that way, so I can forgive it a little bit. And I was intrigued enough in the characters and this play acting that they all are doing. But yeah, it was a little off-putting that there wasn't more to dig into on an emotional level.
Yeah, there was an interesting kind of thread I caught onto on a second viewing, which was that, you know, in the first half hour, the main character, she looks really just kind of like sad and dejected. And like when she's listening to her messages from her grandma, she's just kind of sitting there. And like the blankness of her expression is kind of haunting. But then once she gets into this professor's apartment and is sort of playing her high-end call girl role, she sort of comes alive a little bit. And she's really kind of, they have good conversation and she seems like pleasant company. And that seemed to me to be mirrored later in the film with her boyfriend's character, who we first meet as this like panicked, kind of emotionally insecure guy. And then a few scenes later, we see him working as a mechanic, and he seems a lot more personable as well. So I was wondering if like if there's some kind of thing he's saying there where kind of people can only let go of their worries when they have like a role to do or a task to play out. And, you know, like the professor, he's retired. So the way he kind of remains constant throughout the film could be seen through the fact that he doesn't really have much to do. He's just kind of sitting around all day.
Yeah. I mean, it is an interesting point that these people really only seem to be able to find any kind of satisfaction when they've been given a task and are able to act it out. And like they find some purpose or meaning for themselves in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Though it's weird that the professor kind of rejects that, because when we're first introduced to him, he's desperately trying not to,
to do
some work.
Yeah, good point.
Should we get into spoilers so we can talk a little more freely? I think people can get a basic understanding of our varying feelings towards this movie already, right?
Perhaps. Could I just comment upon the cab scene briefly?
Yes, you may.
So, yeah, during that scene, I was really impressed by, I don't know if you guys took note of this, but there's a weird sort of visual rhyming scheme going on in that sequence with the relationship between herself, her grandmother, and the city of Tokyo. And the way he would focus on her as she's listening to her grandmother's voicemails, and then he would show the city of Tokyo when she's listening to these other less pleasant messages that are being left for her. And then the way he reflects that back by showing her in the cab with the window in front of her, Tokyo reflected off of it as she's listening to her grandmother again, which to me said more about the character than I think much of what followed, it felt like. That established a certain connection and a certain alienation more than the sequences with the professor. And it is kind of strange how, it's fitting because the film is about this fake affection, but at the same time, I do wonder if that is a singular central flaw to like someone in love.
Yeah.
I did notice that rhyming scheme, as you called it. I'm not entirely sure that I follow you the rest of the way with it, because I think that a lot of what happens does inform the character.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not as succinctly. And I mean, obviously this is still in our getting to know you phase. So I feel like everything that we learn about her in those first moments does feel more impactful. I actually was really focused on that conversation that she was having with her fiance over the phone in the restaurant and his insane tactic of having her go into a bathroom to count the tiles so that he could then go to the place that she's claiming to be and count the tiles to make sure that she was actually there. Like, yeah, that is some next level sleeping with the enemy type nonsense that he was pulling. That was frightening. And her kind of resignation to that whole situation set up for me a lot of what happened in the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I guess that even sets up a little bit of the letdown, just because when you kind of see them together, it's just like, and I think the professor even asked her at one point, like, what did you ever see in this guy? It just seems like they have never spent any time together. They just kind of sit in the same car and don't say anything to each other. Yeah. Which is the point, but it still just doesn't feel like there's any history there.
No, absolutely. And it's so weird because from her one side of that conversation, you do get, I got this idea of this hulking, permanently enraged, you know, the stereotypical guy who's awful to his girlfriend. And then when you meet him, he seems kind of pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can see like all this isn't motivated by like a possessiveness in like the traditional 80s high school drama sense of the word, as much as it is by something that's like love. You know, he has ordained himself as her protector and he needs to know everything about her in order to protect her better, he seems to think. And yeah, it was really weird. It was so odd the way that he kind of wilts before this man as he's telling him all this stuff. And he really does seem to care. He's just awful at it, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Can we now get into spoilers?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, let's do it.
So, spoiler alert, we're going to give away some of the twists and some of the greater misunderstandings that happen. Because I think it is interesting to see the way those play out. But I think we can all agree that this is definitely a film you should check out.
Indeed.
Indubitably.
Absolutely. Right. It'll be on VOD next week, actually.
Yes. And if I didn't have a screener, I would look forward to that. So I guess this is one of those few times when I'm going to get to be ahead of the curve, if only for 7 days. So spoilers. I guess, where to begin? I don't want to talk about the ending yet. I'd like to unpack a little more of the interaction between these people first. So Takashi drives Akiko to her school where she has to take an exam. And there he meets Noriaki, who is the fiance. And it's one of those scenes, you know, people sitting in cars and just talking. And, you know, Takashi doesn't even have to lie. No one in this movie has to lie to anyone because everyone will make an assumption and then the person will just kind of play into it. Noriaki thinks that Akiko is this like virginal, not very street smart woman, and so she just kind of lets him assume that and goes on with it, despite the fact that she has been working as a prostitute for at least 2 years that we're aware of. And Takashi is not her grandfather, but Noriaki seems to think that he probably only could be, and so he just kind of lets that go and says yeah. And so they have this conversation wherein Noriaki kind of lays out his ideas related to the fact that if he gets married, apparently his wife will be contractually obligated to tell him everything. And his endgame for getting married doesn't even seem to be, I want to be with this woman forever. It seems to be, I just want to know who the hell this person is. And that's one way to force them to. At which point, Takashi tells him, you know, that means you're not ready to get married. The moment you're ready to get married is when you realize that, you know, you just kind of have to take people on faith. Like, you know, just believe everything that they tell you and be fine with it. What were your thoughts on that scene? Anyone? Or did you not have any? Am I the only one that's stuck out for?
Well, that scene kind of sums up a little bit my sort of hit and miss reaction to the second half, because I love the moment when we first meet Noriaki. It's told through Takashi's perspective in the car. So he like drops the main character off at class or at university or whatever and just kind of thinks she's going to have a pleasant time at class. And right away, Noriaki approaches her and kind of starts shoving her a little bit. And like obviously some tension is introduced. And then Noriaki comes to the car and asks for a lighter, for a cigarette. And then there's maybe a 2 or 3 minute kind of small sequence where they're just looking at each other. One guy's smoking and the other guy's sitting in his car. And there's this great unspoken tension. And then when Noriaki finally gets in the car and they start talking, some of the conflict of the scene felt like released for me. It wasn't as interesting once they started talking about it. But, you know, that's obviously a pivotal scene in the movie because it introduces this idea of him as her grandfather and him not denying that. And then sort of Noriaki's kind of reaction to their relationship sort of dictates where the movie goes in the second half. So, I mean, it's a scene that has to be there, obviously. I just kind of liked half of it, maybe.
That was the first moment in the film where I start to feel a little lost. I didn't think the scene needed to be quite that lengthy. And I felt that they were sort of going in circles after a bit in their discussion, which maybe speaks to a certain authenticity that Kiarostami is striving for. But I did think that perhaps it could have been curtailed a bit there.
There were many circles in the conversations that these people were having.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of extra. But for some reason, I wasn't as turned off by that as I think I usually would. And I think it was just because of the tone and the momentum that the movie still had in spite of that. Like, oh my God, the phone call. This is a perfect example. The phone call when the guy is like, I just need you to translate 5 lines. And Takashi just keeps telling him no. And the guy just will not take no for an answer. And I was like, Takashi, just hang up the phone. Hang up the phone. I was like, this guy is insanely disrespectful. I don't know how late it is, but it seems like it's pretty late. Just hang up the damn phone. Like, things like that. I was just like, this is beyond the point that any reasonable person would have continued to talk to someone. And I don't know if that's a part of the character, because I feel like it could be, considering how we get to know him and his kind of, like, exceedingly kind, deferential nature. He doesn't seem like the type of guy who would just say, you know what, I told you no, and then hang up. But I was just like, I've got it. Please don't make me endure listening to this old man try to dissemble and get this guy off the phone. So I'm totally with you on that. Like, there were moments like that. But I feel like the movie is so in control. It didn't feel like it was spinning its wheels. It just felt like it was taking the long way around. If that makes
sense. Yeah, it's definitely kind of like an element of Kiarostami's approach. Like, he's the kind of guy who would have a character say to his friend that, no, I don't want to do that translation, and then have the friend ask 5 more times or 6 more times. That's just kind of like who he is. And, you know, through that, we kind of get a lot of information about his apartment and the setting. I think during that phone call, actually, Akiko is kind of walking through the apartment and looking at things, so we get information that way.
Yeah, you're right that she does do that when he's still on the phone.
So I guess, I don't know, maybe it was just... That was maybe an instance where I liked the circular nature a little bit better. But it definitely, the car scene between Noriaki and Takashi definitely felt like part of the movie and felt controlled.
And so we get that scene in the car where they're talking and they do have this circuitous conversation. And then Akiko comes back and they drive off under the assumption that he is now going to act as her grandfather. They go to Noriaki's garage. He owns a car mechanic shop. They get a fan belt replaced. There they meet a former police officer who took a course with Takashi once that Takashi was teaching. And upon leaving, the assumption now becomes that there is some way in which Noriaki may find out the truth that he is basically her John. So he goes home, gets a phone call. She needs to be picked up. He picks her up. She has been hit by Noriaki, the presumption is. He takes her back to his apartment. She sits on his steps as he goes off to buy some supplies to help take care of her. And she gets into a out-of-the-blue conversation with a woman who lives downstairs from Takashi. What did we think of this moment in the film? Because I think if there were one moment that didn't ring true for me, it would be this one. And this is the one where I felt it might have been leaning just a little too heavy.
You know what it kind of reminded me of? It reminded me of a scene in... Have you all seen Inland Empire?
Yes.
Yeah.
recently brought up actually on the show. It reminded me of a scene in that film where Laura Dern is crawling along the streets of Los Angeles, and she encounters a pair of homeless people, one of whom is played by Terry Crews, strangely enough. But anyway, there's this Vietnamese woman who starts talking about a hole in her vagina, and and it's a very strange sequence that just does not feel germane to anything that has come before. Now, that's exactly what that scene reminded me of, almost to a T, I would say. What?
I'm trying to remember that scene. That movie is 3 hours long, and I saw it 2 to 3 years ago the last time.
Okay.
So
it is just kind of like a conversation that sort of spurs out of nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't – there's action before and there's action after, but none of the action in either direction feels like it has much of a connecting thread to this scene here. And that is also one of the moments where the movie kind of – I was having a bit of trouble there because I couldn't figure out exactly what he was going for. I guess what is being said sort of speaks to certain themes of the film, but it didn't feel as if it was as if this had not been communicated earlier and in a more expedient fashion.
Yeah, because this woman basically says that, you know, she was in love with Takashi, wanted to marry him. That never happened. He met his wife. He's expecting his daughter and granddaughter to show up, and the assumption that the woman makes is that Akiko is his granddaughter, which is, you know, it's funny because they had just kind of pulled off that con with someone else, but it also just kind of makes a lot of sense because you see an old man and a young woman, and the assumption is probably that they're related, and just going off of relevant ages, probably granddaughter. But I mean, there's a bunch of other stuff. Like, this woman is just so open, so ready to spill all this information. Like, P.S., I wanted to bang your grandfather once. And again, there's a cultural element. I don't know how open the Japanese are. As an Irish New Yorker, I mean, I don't tell anyone shit. So it's just weird having that come in. And then she's also got a handicapped brother.
Yeah, a lot of stuff.
Yeah, there's just so much. There's so much that happens in that short time, and I'm not sure what any of it is saying that has, like you said, Nick, that hasn't been said before in a little more expedient manner. And I just don't know, because then we move from that into the last 5 minutes of the film.
Right. I was gonna say it's also curious that the film ends so soon after,
right.
And there is no, there's really nothing that goes back to it. I guess
there's no return. Because, like, it doesn't pay off in any way
because there's action happening outside. Maybe I did think back to the woman, at least.
I did, because I had the concern that, like, now something's going to happen to that poor woman and her brother.
But yeah, man, I mean,
he's handicapped.
Yeah, so. Right.
I mean, that last 5 minutes is like a really kind of awesome, unconventional suspense sequence. But I feel like there had to be more to that scene with the neighbor than just to, like, set up the suspense. I just don't know what it was.
This is a... And I'm not saying any of this because I didn't like it or it affected the film negatively for me. I just, you know, as part of a well-rounded, in-depth analysis, you have to point out the good on top of the bad. And you know,
I honestly have kind of forgotten about the scene, so that
should it's still in my head. So it's there. But the last 5 minutes, like you said, Danny, were very suspenseful. And I was thinking as I was watching it how a normal director would have cut that scene,
Right?
And you would have followed Noriaki, because Noriaki shows up, I guess we should say, pounding on the door, and luckily they have a video
visual.
Yeah, it's one of those door things where you can buzz people in, and luckily this has a video thing on it, and you can hear him running up the stairs, pounding on the door, then running down and doing something, but you don't get to see any of the things that he's doing. And a normal movie would have followed him out there and given you almost I assume that he broke the windows of the car because you hear some windows smashing or glass shattering, I think.
Yeah, there were a lot of kind of like violent sounds that before the last one.
So I had this vision of like almost like the Big Lebowski, like Walter messing up that person's car. Yeah, so it was interesting to me that it stayed in the apartment with these two characters.
What a strange reference.
Right, but I was just like, I don't know why that's the one that popped in my head. But, it was just interesting that it stayed in the apartment. The only problem I had with it, though, is that he keeps looking out of these windows, and unfortunately, I have no idea what those windows look down onto. we're never really given the point of view out of those windows.
Yeah, so I wonder.
For me, that broke the tension a little bit because I didn't know. He's obviously looking and he might be seeing something, but I don't know what he's checking. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Right. Okay. Yeah, I'm glad that we didn't really know, because I think you would have to sacrifice the sequence's use of sound, which, as he talked about, is so effective.
Yes, and it is very effective.
What's amazing is how I watched this movie on my computer with earbuds in, so I could almost map where this character was in the scene and what he was doing, and I could visualize it all. And that really if that doesn't, you know, say everything about the incredible complexity of the sound design, then I don't know what does. It's interesting how this and the closing and the opening sequences of this film both rely upon that, about how you're sort of filling in the visual blanks for yourself. And, you know, there are times where I wish the film had maybe, where I wish Kiarostami had done that a bit more, honestly.
It's weird. If he had. No, it's funny because I agree, and I loved the use of the sound. And oddly enough, it made me think of Looper.
Expand.
Yeah. Okay, there's a scene in Looper wherein she hits the little frog toy to call Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and it stays in the room with her, but you can hear his footsteps, and so you can chart his movement. Yeah. So I personally love things like that because sound in a film rarely gets used in that way. A lot of times, like, you know, you can hear footsteps, but it's just to alert you that someone's coming, but it doesn't give you any sense of geography or speed or any greater details. So in films like Looper, where it's like it's a science fiction action film, and then in this one where it's more of a personal drama, it's interesting how they're both used to great effect to create a mood that suits those films. I know, again, I don't know why this film made me think of both Looper and The Big Lebowski, respectively, but it did, so deal with it.
All right.
So let's just get to this ending, because this ending, again, comes out of nowhere. So we've set up a situation wherein a number of false realities have collapsed, and now these people are stuck in a situation that none of them ever wanted to be in. And Takashi is looking out his windows as he hears the bedlam going on outside, because Noriaki is upset and is going on a rampage. And then a brick or some heavy item comes through the window. Takashi hits the deck, not because he's struck, I believe, but simply out of shock and of concern for another object soon to follow. Credits.
Mm-hmm. The credits actually start playing over the shot.
Yeah, before it fades to black, credits. And then, like I said, when that happened, because at first the shot's still there, and I'm like, okay, he's going to get up, she's going to come over, and it's going to be like a reverse. It's like two people who've both been hurt by Noriaki, and now they're both helping each other. And no, then the credits start coming up, and I was just like, what the hell? I actually rewound 5 minutes to rewatch to see if I'd missed something, and like just to confirm again that he hadn't been hit, because he's standing in front, it's a two-paned window, he's standing on the left, and the object comes through the pane on the right. So I was just like, I don't even know what to think right now. Anyone want to take a stab at this now that we've had some hindsight to go over it?
Well, we've talked a little bit about how kind of extreme the movie often is in terms of either filming the city of Tokyo when you look at the cab sequence or the professor's apartment. And you mentioned how in that final 5 minute sequence, we never see outside through the window. He's really trying to like keep us in that isolated environment, and the window breaking, I guess, is, you know, the end of that sort of, to quote a recent release, safe haven of the, of the home. Oh, so, man. I mean, I kind of get the shot thematically. I just don't know if it's really a warranted way to end the narrative.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, like, thematically it makes sense, I guess. And it's a fine true moment in the film, and yet is that the best place for it to end? Is there another place it could have ended, even? Because I was, as it was approaching this ending, I was wondering, like, how is this gonna stop?
I think that it shows a certain disinterest that Kiarostami has with these characters, honestly, that he doesn't follow up with Akiko to see what exactly has happened with her, or even the scummy fiance, or the old woman, or her crippled brother. What's happening with them? Well, no, I don't really care about them, but...
Yeah, screw them.
Yeah, I do... You know, having just seen the ending, I am trying to figure out if the movie is maybe... If it's much more cynical than even a first viewing would suggest. Because that is sort of what the ending indicates to me, is that their story is over and you should move on. That's it. There is something that I do find a little upsetting about that, honestly.
Yeah, it is weird that it's kind of the same feeling I got. Like, all right, it's over, nothing to see here. It's like that, and I'm sure that there's something to be said about the fact that, like, these aren't real people. So all the emotions that you've seen aren't real, and these people are actors, and this is a movie, and you shouldn't be wrapped up in it, you should be fine with it leaving here. But I'm kind of not. And as much as I enjoyed the rest of the film, just that, like you said, the cynicism of that ending, if that is indeed what they were going for, is a little off-putting.
Yeah, and going further into the sound, I also thought that it really was just this amazing force of, even though I said how there is something cynical about it, there's this amazing force of emotion in the sound of that glass breaking. And because it's what Danny said, it is the intrusion of that private safe space, the safe haven.
The safe haven.
And that is, the way it's communicated there is, it is more about the sound than the image of the window breaking, because what is... I mean, for the both of you, what's sticking in your mind in the time sense? You might remember.
Actually, the abruptness of it. It's funny that you say that, because I don't think of the window, the shattering, so much as I do of the curtain fluttering back into place.
Mm.
So I don't know what that says about me. You know, the curtain covering the window, making it seem as though it's fine. This is one of those movies where I feel like I'm going to reference my parents again. My parents often say, and I think I've told everyone this before, that it sometimes sounds like I'm making it up just to make a movie seem deeper than it is. And this is a movie where I feel like I could do that. I don't know if that's a function of the craft of the director or my desire for it to make more sense. But it's almost purely related to just this ending, because I'm still feeling really knocked back on my heels by the abruptness of the finality of it.
Yeah, I think one of the things too is that there's something really satisfying about the movie's like sense of mystery. We talked about, you know, like that opening scene where it begins with a voice that we don't see, and then we finally see her, and then we're kind of trying to figure out who she is. And so there's like the film kind of moves with this hope that, like, all right, we're getting like maybe one or two more bits of information with each passing scene, and then it ends, and like the immediate reaction other than the suspense is just kind of like, ah, oh, like that's it, or like there's nothing, there's not one more scene to like tell us one more thing.
Yeah, it's odd. I can't think of a better way to put it. I don't know why it stopped there. I don't know why it couldn't have gone on just a little bit longer. I don't know. This is a weird way to wrap this up. This movie's gotten some pretty rapturous praise from people. We all seem to have enjoyed it, and we all seem to like talking about it and chewing it over. Do you see this as the type of movie that's going to stick around until your end of the year list? And again, I know that's an asinine question to ask 2 months into the year. But considering how much Certified Copy showed up on people's lists, considering how much talk has gone on around this film, and it has been out there for a while, so there has been time for it to be debated over already, though not by us. Like, is the visceral reaction that you got when you walked out of this film, in a non-literal sense, since we all were watching screeners, I believe. Though, Danny, did you see this previously? You said you saw this.
Yeah, this is my second viewing.
So when you saw it, because sometimes you can just tell, you walk out of a film and you just know. Like, did this hit you in that way? Because when I saw Certified Copy, I knew. And this one, I'm a lot more ambivalent.
Yeah, I know with Certified Copy, when I first saw that, my knowledge of this director was kind of limited. So I think that was like maybe an honorable mention on my list that year. But the second viewing, just was like incredible. And that movie is definitely like a kind of almost best of the new decade kind of thing. And like Someone in Love, seeing it again, it doesn't have that type of impact. So, yeah, I think it is interesting, though. This movie premiered in Cannes, to kind of mixed reviews, which I suppose is typical of that environment. But I know when it came to New York, it got a lot more sort of universal praise. So it's kind of an interesting case of like an auteur-driven movie sort of gaining in stature as it goes through the festival circuit. A lot of the times it feels like if it hits strong the first time, the rest of the festivals sort of just keep that momentum going rather than changing it.
All right. And Nick, what about yourself?
When I first, when it ended, I did not think that the movie would make my top 10. I mean, it's probably, yeah, it is the best 2013 movie I've seen so far, but this is the second 2013 movie I've seen. So
I was about to say, that's...
But it could. I mean, I won't rule that out because I think that I'm definitely
not trying to make us set up our lists already. I want to be clear about that.
Right. No, I'm just saying I'll definitely be watching it again and before the year ends. And I mean, I have my screener of it and I would like to view it again soon. So maybe on a second viewing, it'll open up more for me. I would say that one thing that sort of will maybe increase appreciation of it is to read some different work on it. There's a very good piece by a friend of mine, David Ehrlich, who wrote a very long review at the site Reverse Shot, which helped me get a better grasp of the film. And it didn't necessarily make me like it more, but I did read that and I sort of understood certain things that were not entirely clear on a first viewing. And I think that an experience like that, where I'm going to be thinking about this movie for a long time and I'm going to be rewatching it, that could elevate it for me. It's happened before, and I would not rule out it happening again. And I'd be happy to see that happen here.
Yeah, I keep going back to The Master in my head. I keep referencing movies, talking about this movie. I had the same kind of reaction to the ending there. I knew that I had seen something that had its moments of questionable judgment, but I trusted in the vision of the director and I liked it, but I wasn't sure. But with The Master, walking out of it, I knew that it was going to be one of the best that I'd seen that year. And maybe it's a little more fair to say that because that was later on in the year. But this movie, I have all the ambivalence regarding some of the themes and choices of The Master without the certainty that it's going to endure. Though luckily we do have screeners, so I will be able to revisit it. And as the year goes on, if I watch it again and I get a new appreciation for it or start to understand some parts of it better, I'll be sure to let you all know. I haven't read anything about it yet, outside of like seeing some tweets and random things, but I haven't read any in-depth analysis because I didn't want it to influence what I spoke of here today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually thought of The Master after this movie, funny enough, because I was thinking about how when that movie came out, there were a bunch of people online who were saying, oh, the film is so complex and it's so opaque. And then I saw it and I thought, no, it's really not. Guys,
no, it's not. It's not.
It's really not. So just stop, please. Stop with that. And then it came up because I thought of this film. And, you know, it makes, in terms of narrative complexity, I mean, it makes The Master look like the Rugrats movie, honestly. So I just thought.
I don't know about that. I think The Master.
No, I mean, I love The Master. I'm just saying, I'm talking about in terms of how much you have to decide for yourself and how much
stories
you want. I just.
The Master
was actually a moment of frustration.
I was pretty quick to pick up on what The Master was saying. I just wasn't sure how all the pieces fit in the larger picture. And this, I feel like the question of what it's saying is making it even harder to fit in the pieces. But it is something I look forward to seeing again. So everybody check this movie out when it hits VOD next week if it's not in the theater near you already. And let us move on. Let us talk about the things that are coming to Blu-ray and DVD on February 19th. We have a couple of very interesting things coming out. Game of Thrones, the complete second season, which is an excellent TV show. It's a kind of a pulp medieval soap opera, but it's fun. We have Argo, which is nominated for every award under the sun except Best Director at the Academy Awards.
That is not one of the interesting things coming out.
I thought you actually liked Argo. Was I wrong?
I liked it, but it's not at all an interesting film.
You weren't entertained by it?
That doesn't make it interesting, no.
I'm not talking... Never mind. I was going to say, the interesting thing is that you may be interested in picking it up.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, it's enjoyable. I'm just saying, it's...
Okay, anyway. The Terminator, Top Gun, The Insider, Sinister.
Yeah.
Anna Karenina, Best in Show. Monsters, Inc. is hitting a re-release. Highlander 2.
Atlas Shrugged Part 2.
Oh, goody. Yeah, I just saw that Atlas Shrugged Part 2. Right. And yeah, that's...
Oh, they got Undefeated on there, which won Best Documentary.
Oh, yeah.
Last year?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a good movie.
I wonder why that's just coming out.
Yeah, I don't know.
Say, I'm surprised that's only coming out now.
The buzz is kind of... you want to release that right after it wins the Oscars, guys.
Really, really should have thought about that a little harder.
Remember that movie, guys? Fun Size?
I was about to say, yeah, Fun Size is coming out. That's the little kid in the Spider-Man outfit. And
yeah.
Waiting for the Criterion.
So yeah, I'm gonna say that you should check out Argo if you have not already. It's a fantastic film. Also, I'm gonna throw my personal largest recommendation towards Anna Karenina, which I know Nick does not agree with. So Nick, why don't you balance me out? What do you think is something worth picking up this weekend or this week?
I suppose among the selection, the best is actually On the Waterfront, which is coming up from a Criterion, but. In almost any week, that would be the best selection. So yes. It's a little unfair. Obviously that's something that you should pick up. If you haven't seen On the Waterfront, I don't know what the fuck you're doing. But anyway, the pick I'll go with is The Insider from Michael Mann, which is, I think, the best film from a career full of extraordinary pictures. It is, I think that is actually the last movie Mann shot on film, interesting enough, or at least fully on film. And it's also, in some ways, the most conventional plot-wise, but it's, I think it's the most complete thing he's ever made. It is the most effective, too, emotionally. And I'm talking about a filmmaker who a lot of people will, allege does not make emotionally affecting work. Have we all seen The Insider?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that is an incredible film. Maybe the best movie of 1999, which is... an all-time year.
I was about to say, isn't that Saving Private Ryan, The Thin Red Line?
No, that's 1998.
Oh, that's right. Never mind. All right.
Way to go.
Strike that. That's getting erased. Okay. Danny, did you have anything beyond what we said?
Yeah, Insider and On the Waterfront. Tough to compete. Even Undefeated. Can't outshine those two.
All right. Well, that's good that we have some good DVDs coming out, because honestly, this crop of movies does not look great. So we have Snitch coming to theaters this coming Friday, February 22nd. It stars Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Susan Sarandon. What? Okay. That is about a father who goes undercover with the DA in order to get his son a reduced sentence or something. Keep saying it's based on a true story. I don't know what true story. I know that I read something in The New Yorker about the incredibly dangerous world of like teenagers who get turned into snitches to get reduced sentences, and how like these people wind up dead because they have very little protection. And I pray to God that they did not adapt that quote unquote and make it into this movie.
Yeah. I feel like this is probably based on a true story. The same way Unstoppable is based on a true story.
There was once a train that did not stop.
Yeah.
Let's not besmirch Unstoppable though. That movie's fantastic. We then have Dark Skies, which is, it seems like it's a haunting movie by way of an alien abduction movie. So, I mean, like, that's vaguely all right, I guess. It looks honestly pretty crap. And yet, I was telling the guys before we started filming, there are moments, and that's why I don't think this is a spoiler, because it's in the TV and actually theatrical trailer. There are moments in this film wherein someone will round a corner and there is a tall, spindly, large-headed, like, gray-looking alien standing over them. And that seriously scares the shit out of me every time I see it. I had a huge fear of being abducted by aliens when I was a kid. I don't know what it was about the late 80s, early 90s that instilled that fear in me and a lot of my friends.
The X-Files?
I mean, it may have been the X-Files, but I feel like part of the reason the X-Files was so awesome and so embraced was because it was already there. There was like a TV movie with Claire Danes too.
Oh wow, that sounds really good.
I am only just now remembering that is even a thing. And I mean, that came out and that scared the crap out of me. There was that movie like Fire in the Sky, and that was awful. So I mean, part of me is like, this movie looks awful, I shouldn't go see it. And then the other part of me is like, hey, you were afraid of aliens, maybe this movie is actually like tailor made for you. Oh, you know what? You know what? I bet it wasn't even Claire Danes. I think it was worse. I think it was the oldest daughter from Full House.
I couldn't tell you.
I am proud to tell you. I could not.
You're proud to tell me that you have no idea. Yeah,
I have no idea what her.
You've never seen Full House?
No.
And you only saw, Top Gun last August.
Yeah.
Man, you were killing me, man. I don't even know how to deal with you right now.
I watched a lot of C-SPAN as a kid, so.
I would not be surprised if that was true.
Yeah. That was sad.
All right. Anyway, and then there's another movie coming out called Inescapable, which I've never heard of.
No, that's good.
Yeah. So let's get into the random recommendations really quickly, since we've already taken up quite a bit of time. Nick, why don't you kick us off and tell us what you saw that you think we should check out?
I'm going to go with three films, actually. There's some heavy hitters that, being a bastard, I will sing its praises, but you cannot get them anywhere. So I'm sorry about that. But and it's also connected to what we're talking about, because this past week I went to the Film Society of Lincoln Center in New York City, and I saw Abbas Kiarostami's Coker trilogy, which is it goes without saying, it's three movies. It's not like it's going to be a trilogy and it's four. Then it'd be a quadrilogy.
That would be quite a twist.
Yeah. The works are Where's the Friend's Home, Life and Nothing More, and Through the Olive Trees. And the first movie is, I won't get into it too much, but it is the most conventional of them. But then the second is about the director of the first going to look for the actors from that. And then the third film is about the making of a scene in the second, if that makes any sense.
Whoa.
It's exactly that. I had that exact reaction.
I did a completely nonverbal response where like one of my eyebrows went up, and then I realized that we were basically doing radio and no one could see that.
Right. And it is, to see it back to back to back was one of the best cinematic experiences I've had in a very long time. And I wish that these movies were available somewhere, because I feel like it is, I don't want to say the best trilogy I've ever seen, but I might say the best trilogy I've ever seen. It is just really something else. It's actually, it's three great films that are all connected to each other in these fascinating ways. It's unlike anything I've ever seen, honestly.
Wow.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm going to give my thumbs up.
All right. So thumbs up to that. Danny, what about yourself?
Oh, well, I too had another fun cinema experience with an older title. It was Lost Highway from David Lynch. Yeah. We brought up earlier. Yeah. Have you guys seen that one?
It's my favorite Lynch film.
Yeah, no, it was awesome. And it has, I guess at the time at least, it had kind of a mixed response, because the movie's kind of has like this insane turn maybe about 45 minutes or an hour into it. But it was just a lot of fun. And part of the fun of it is that I saw it with my brother, who is a Lynch lover as well as a really squeamish movie watcher, which does not tend to go hand in hand. So there are all these violent moments throughout the movie where he has to turn away. And I just like look at him like, yeah, what do you expect? But like he has to see the Lynch. It's like a drug for him. And so I always have fun watching David Lynch movies with him. And also the crowd was great. And it's funny too, because they were showing it in Brooklyn as part of a Richard Pryor kind of career retrospective. And he has about like four lines. and maybe two of them are funny. But for everyone, every line he said, the audience was just going nuts. So that was also kind of funny.
It seems like it was just an excuse to show Lost Highway.
Oh, completely, completely.
Was it one on? Of those things like, let's really screw with these people.
Was it on 35mm too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a great print. And
I saw Coker, it was all three were on 35mm, and that just
fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. I didn't get a chance to watch a lot of movies this past week, so I'm going to have to go with something that's on Netflix Instant that we actually did a full review of, one of our first episodes, I think. Sleepless Night, the French action film about a father trying to get his son back from the drug kingpin who stole him in retribution for the theft of some drugs. Holy crap. Like, the more I talk about this movie and the more I try to explain the plot to certain people, like, The first 15 minutes of that movie are a normal movie's worth of action and stuff happening. It's really good. It holds up completely, and it is it's a fun way to spend a Friday night where you don't feel like doing anything else.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, we have a whole episode about it, so if anyone's more interested in hearing further details, check it out. Also, P.S., if anyone's interested, I found out. It was the older daughter from Full House. It was called Visitors of the Night, and it was a TV movie from 1995.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, it has 5.2 stars on IMDb, and you can buy it off of Amazon.
The first time that has been mentioned this entire decade.
I was about to say, no one else remembers this movie. Though it does have Stephen McCady in it, so...
Ooh.
Yeah, right? Anyway, that is it for today. Let us tell you where we can be found on the internet in the interim. Danny, let's start with you.
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And Nick.
Thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/BrianJRowan, on my personal blog, dearfilm.net, and on thefilmstage.com. And, interestingly enough, I will have a television show that is hitting the internet sometime in the coming week. So,
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
It's exciting.
It is. It's exciting. I'm not 100% psyched about being on camera, but it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting. It's a new experience, so that's a good thing. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and make sure to check in next week when we will be reviewing something else to be determined. A wide number of my friends don't really seem to give a shit when I bring up something like this.
Including your dog?
Including the dog, yes. That is
dog
actually,
is very upset.
That is not my dog. Holy God. She's climbing up the back of my chair. Is there anyone among us who feels that they can give a better summary than what I was... Yes, Scout, I'm sure you could. You go over there. Is there anyone among us who...
That's not at all an accurate summation of the film, by the way. Your dog does not understand.
No, the dog is completely out of line. I assume that he broke the windows of the car or something, because I heard...
No barking.
Scout agrees with me.
You heard a dog barking?
No,
Husky!